Immigration and border security are front and center for the current Congress. What role will South Florida's delegation play? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. President Trump spoke to the nation last night, holding his stance on his desire for a border wall. South Florida has some new faces representing in Congress. How will they deal with the government shutdown, and what are their plans for immigration reform? And the issue of immigration and refugees will be a key component to this year's State of the World Conference, starting at FIU tomorrow. We'll talk with a former president of Costa Rica and a former member of the Obama administration who dealt with migration and refugees. Also, Governor Ron DeSantis has announced his first pick to put on the Florida Supreme Court, a Cuban-American woman from Hialeah. And we'll get an update on the lawsuit Airbnb has filed against the city of Miami Beach. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Barbara Lagoa is the newest member of the Florida Supreme Court. Governor Ron DeSantis made the announcement this morning at the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami. Lagoa is one of the three replacements that Governor DeSantis is expected to make to the court, and she becomes the first Cuban-American in the high court's history. Reporter Danny Rivera was at the announcement, and he joins us now to give us the details. Danny, thanks so much, man.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us real quickly about the announcement this morning. Governor DeSantis, again, mentioning Barbara Lagoa to the Florida Supreme Court. What do we know about her?
So we know she's been an appellate judge in the Florida's 3rd District Court of Appeals for 12 years. That's the district that handles appeals cases in Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. She's been there for 12 years. She was appointed by Governor Jeb Bush. She's a Miami, Florida native. She was born in Miami, raised in Hialeah. Her parents are Cuban-American. She's actually going to be, at this point, we're going to have two Cuban-Americans on the state Supreme Court. Notably, we're not going to have a black justice for the first time in 36 years. But, I mean, 24 hours into his actual term, Governor DeSantis has really thrown another bone to the Cuban-American community down here.
What happened today at the announcement? What did he say about why he chose her? What was his decision there?
He said she has some of the most experience out of anyone that was on the final list of candidates. She has a tremendous respect for the rule of law, he underscored, being that her family left Cuba. And he said, you know, she understands what rule of law is, the importance of the separation of these different parts of the government, and the importance of the judicial system. So he kind of leaned on her biography to a degree, in addition to her actual knowledge of the subject.
And this is one of three picks that the governor is going to be making. What did he hint about his other two choices?
He hasn't hinted too much about his other choices. There's basically a final list of candidates that was released by the Judicial Nominating Commission, which is initiated by former governor at this point, Rick Scott, on his way out. So there was 11 names. So there's still, I mean, it's not exactly clear who's going to make these other seats. There, he has two more to fill. Basically, we had three justices just leave the office, just leave
because
the bench.
Because of retirement, yeah.
Because of age limitations. And those three were actually pretty liberal. They were all nominated by Lalton Chiles, who was the last Democratic governor that we had before Jeb Bush took office in 1999. So DeSantis has been very transparent about this. He says he's going to nominate people that are more in line with what he thinks of the state, and he's declared judicial activism is a thing of the past here. So the court is going to lean more conservative than it has.
And do we get a sense too as to when he's going to make those other two picks?
Not exactly, but it's going to happen in the coming weeks. I mean, he's been very clear on this. He's had the final list. He said that he has met with each of the final candidates individually, and he's spoken to them. They've been interviewed by the commission. He gave the indication that he knows pretty well where he's going with this. I just can't tell you he's going to do it tomorrow. He's going to do it the next day. But this is the first, and it'll be a major change to the courts here.
Well, again, that first announcement came today. Governor DeSantis was at the Miami Freedom Tower this morning. He announced Barbara Lagoa of Miami, an appellate judge here who grew up in Hialeah, is going to be the next justice on the Florida Supreme Court. Again, he's got two more picks to make, and we'll tell you all about them as soon as we know what they are, because he hasn't told us when he's going to make those. Again, WLRN's reporter Danny Rivera was there at the scene. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Also, we want to note there will be more in-depth conversations on the new Florida Supreme Court pick coming up on Friday on the Florida and South Florida roundups. Well, still to come, South Florida has some new faces that they're sending to Congress. What will that mean for issues of immigration, infrastructure, climate change? We're going to talk with political strategist Fernanda Mondi, host of the podcast Strange States. That's coming up next. Yeah. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, in a national televised address to the nation last night, President Trump called upon Congress to take action in passing a federal budget that would include $5.7 billion for border security. The funding remains highly contentious in Congress, especially among some of South Florida's new delegation to the House. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, one of the more senior members of the delegation, argued this week the president has a, quote, border wall fetish. What role will South Florida's new congressional delegation have in ending the federal shutdown? And who are some of the new faces in the delegation that you should know about? We are joined now by Fernanda Mondi. He's the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Amandi, a political communications and strategy firm. He's also a political science lecturer at the University of Miami, and he hosts the podcast All About Politics, Strange Days. We should also note, by the way, that he was a key strategist and pollster for Donna Shalala's campaign for Congress. Fernanda Mondi joins us back in studio again. Haven't talked to you in a while. How's it going?
It's great to be back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well, as we both recover from illnesses over the holidays. So much to talk about. Let's start with this. Federal government shutdown now going into 3 weeks, still on this issue of border security. Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had their opportunity to respond to the president's primetime address last night, arguing they put forth the legislation to get the government back up and running, and that immigrants don't pose a serious threat to national security. What have we heard from South Florida's delegation about the shutdown and about the border wall?
You know, I think for the most part, the delegation down here, first we have to recognize, Lewis, really did change the composition of the delegation. What used to be really represented, almost balanced between Republicans and Democrats.
Now, it was a 4-4.
It was a 4-4. Yeah. Now it's almost, I think the only Republican left standing is Congressman Diaz-Balart. So I think those dynamics have changed the outlook and the perspective. And outside of Congressman Diaz-Balart, right now, the Democratic representatives, all of them to a man and woman, are maintaining the line of Schumer and Pelosi. I think they believe that the Democrats have the leverage in this fight against the president. They believe that the government needs to be opened immediately. And I think we've heard, whether it's Congresswoman Emmer Castle Powell, Shalala, Congressman Deutsch, Congresswoman Frankel, Wasserman Schultz, Congresswoman Wilson, all say the time for negotiating is during a functioning government, that can be done separately. And I think you've seen those comments echo throughout.
So several of the members of the delegation play critical roles as it relates to funding to the federal government's essential services. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is expected to be one of the dozen cardinals mm-hmm. on the Appropriations Committee. First, just remind us, too, of the significance of the cardinal position.
It's fundamentally important because, remember, the main job of the Congress is to appropriate funds. I mean, it appropriates the funds that make the federal government function. And Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, as a cardinal, has almost one of those direct responsibilities, almost live or die power in terms of what agencies, what projects do get funded or don't get funded. So you cannot diminish her influence, particularly now, Lewis, that the Democrats have taken the majority position in Congress. You know, that even a cardinal in the minority has some influence before the turnover. Now, with the backdrop of a Democratic majority, it's even magnified more so. So I don't think you can diminish that role at all.
You know, I mean, as I mentioned, you were part of Congresswoman Shalala's campaign mm-hmm. for Congress. How much was the issue of border security and immigration a part of that campaign, or did South Florida voters have something else in mind?
You know, it's impossible to suggest that the immigration issue was the most important issue. But that said, in our polling and throughout the campaign trail over and over again, we saw that the issue was one of concern. Why we have a tremendous population made up of immigrants here in South Florida, many of them part of the electorate, quite candidly. And remember also that the campaign was set against the backdrop of some images that we had never seen in the United States before, where children were separated from families, detained in some cases, whether it was in cages or in foster facilities. That cast a huge pall over the coverage of the campaign, and it impacted a lot of voters' perspectives. So I think it was a very important issue in this campaign.
And getting the bigger view, how did South Florida view the issue of immigration compared to the rest of the country?
Well, I mean, I think there's a greater sensitivity here in South Florida. You have to remember that the Hispanic electorate here, which is one where we see a lot of connections or visceral relations to the immigrant and the undocumented immigrant population, you see it, you live it here. So South Florida is always going to be a much more sensitive, much more visceral community responding to these, much in the same way that you see a lot of the border states react to immigration. Whereas in other parts of the country, it's a concern, but it's a much more of a distance, almost an academic issue, whereas here, it's a personal one. It impacts the relationships that people have, in many cases, workers, colleagues, family members. So you see South Florida, I think, have a much more compassionate approach when it comes to the subject, and by design, by definition, a much more interested one.
Do we get a sense, though, of Trump supporters here in South Florida and their feelings about this border wall, that, you know, the fight that the president's continued, he's going to continue the shutdown until he gets what he wants? Again, we're an interesting state, but we're not on that border. But we are an interesting state in the fact that we do have a lot of immigrants that come through.
Well, to your question, which is a very good one, let's first look at one thing. In my diagnosis, I mean, we're living through something I've never quite seen before in my lifetime, which is when you describe what is, quote, a Trump supporter. Given the reaction, it's almost an implicit recognition that anything that the president says, if you're a Trump supporter, is the right position. Even, you know, you don't have personal reservations, you don't contradict what the president says. It's almost a cult of personality type of base of support for the president, where he literally, and many of them will articulate this, feel that the president can do no wrong. He almost has this divine providential responsibility. And as such, I think that's why you don't see much erosion or deterioration in that Trump supporter base. Now, you get outside of that, in terms of Republicans, independents, and even, of course, some Democrats that take exception, I think that's where you have a little bit of the dissent. But that hardcore Trump base, which many of us know some of these people living in South Florida, I haven't seen much movement there. There's almost lockstep support for the president's postures and positions on this immigration issue and the wall.
Does that continue if the government shutdown continues? I look back to, for example, a piece from Patty Mazzei of the New York Times, mm-hmm. Who used to work at the Miami Herald, mm-hmm. and she was looking at the panhandle and how the government shutdown's impacting communities up there. And, you know, you've got people, a lot of people there who did vote for Trump, but they're feeling this really hard right now. And so do you think if this continues, does anything change?
Well, we're on the precipice of a major milestone within the next couple of days. And that would be, Lewis, this could become the longest government shutdown. Even though it's a partial shutdown, it would be the longest government shutdown in the history of the United States. To be surpassed, I think it was 21 days, which is the record that happened under Bill Clinton's administration. Every single day that this goes on, I think there are going to be segments that, whether it's because they're dependent on the paycheck that comes, or they're part of a household or a family that is dependent on either their government service that is not functioning, I think it does have impact. But it's been remarkable to me to still see many folks, in fact, we've seen case after case of people that currently work for the government that also are either furloughed or out of work, that are supporters of President Trump, that say, let him keep it, I'll get another job if I have to do so. We'll see if that dynamic changes when this milestone reaches. For every additional day, we get into a historic shutdown.
Again, talking with Fernand Amandi, the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Amandi, a political communications and strategy firm here in Miami. And we're discussing South Florida's new congressional delegation and the impact that they're going to have in Washington, D.C., again, amidst this shutdown, but also so many other big issues. And again, to note, Amandi did work as a lead strategist for Donna Shalala's campaign for Congress. The other freshman congressperson joining Shalala in office is, as you mentioned, Debbie Mercosal Powell. She campaigned heavily on the healthcare reform issue. Tell us a bit more about her background and what she's bringing to office.
You know, I think as someone who comes at this, a relative newcomer to politics, I mean, Congresswoman Mercosso Powell really only started to get involved and engage in the last few years. So I think you always see when you have someone like that, an energy and enthusiasm, maybe not as much as the jaded practical reality that you tend to see in more longtime office holders. Also the first Ecuadorian American in office, one of the leading Latina members of Congress across the country now. But I think, like you said, she was really laser focused on that issue of the Affordable Care Act, part of it because that district, which is the 26th congressional district in Florida, one of the largest in terms of people that enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. But I think that's what makes this shutdown in the initial days of this Democratic Congress so difficult, because many members, of which Congresswoman Mercosso Powell is one of them, were hoping to almost have this frenetic 100 days of legislative activity where they were able to address issues like the prevention of the elimination of pre-existing conditions. They were going to try and legislate around that, even though there have been steps taken by this Trump administration to pull those away. That's been put on the ice box because of the shutdown. So I think many of folks are trying to find their footing and try and find a way forward while we deal with the specter of the shutdown, which really is the be-all, end-all issue in Washington right now.
And of course, there are a number of returning faces to Congress from South Florida. Familiar one, Ted Deutsch. He continues his role in the House Ethics Committee and the Judiciary Committee. The latter role is important in terms of congressional investigations into the president, right?
Absolutely. And Congressman Deutsch really took on a more high-profile national role because of those investigations. He was also the congressman that oversees the area where the Parkland High School Marjorie Stoneman Douglas massacre happened. So he also gained a real high-profile prominence on gun reform and gun control issue. Another issue, by the way, that the Democrats are ready to introduce legislation on, which would be full background checks on any private purchases. So I would anticipate seeing Congressman Deutsch not only step up his national profile on the issue of the judiciary, but also on this issue of gun safety and gun control, which is one the Democrats, many of them, campaigned on in this last cycle.
And of course, you know, as it, coming back to this question about, you know, investigating the president, investigating the administration, what do you think Democrats do now? I mean, do we wait for the Mueller investigation to play out, or do they press on this, or is there a danger, a risk of pressing on any, even saying the impeachment word?
You know, whether you are a supporter of President Trump or an antagonist or down the middle neutral, I mean, I think for a lot of people that they've got to wonder, it seems he's certainly an unorthodox president. And for many, he's actually committing impeachable crimes on a daily basis. And I know many folks are saying, why aren't they beginning the impeachment process now? And I think here, I would, just looking at it from an analyst point of view, I think the Democratic posture is the correct one. That there is an investigation happening, which at least through this moment, through this conversation, seems to be going forward unimpeded, which is, of course, the Mueller investigation. When that investigation leads to a position where it's inarguable that if they find and conclude that impeachable crimes have taken place, that is when I think you will see the attention shift from kind of this cautious wait and see mode to proactive investigation, whether it's actually introducing articles of impeachment or not. This is where the problem lies for the administration, whereas with a Democratic Congress now, they have subpoena power. They could begin these investigations in earnest. And the other thing, Lewis, you now have former members of the administration, whether it be former Defense Secretary Mattis, former Chief of Staff John Kelly. These are people that can now be subpoenaed and testified before congressional committees. So I think that's going to play a potential role as well.
The lone Republican in the delegation, as you pointed out earlier, Mario Diaz-Balart, will play a significant role as it relates to transportation and infrastructure projects here in South Florida. Explain his significance in any future federally funded development in the region.
You know, you can't underestimate the importance and the influence. You talked about Debbie Wasserman Schultz's role as a cardinal. Well, Mario Diaz-Balart has a similar type function because he is on the Transportation Appropriations Committee. So when it comes to a lot of the progress and a lot of the allocation of resources, and we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars nationally, not to mention the ability to do so here in South Florida, Mario Diaz-Balart had that power as the chairman of that committee in a Republican-controlled Congress. But even in a Democratic-controlled Congress, he as the ranking member still has tremendous influence, particularly because of his close relations with the Democratic chair. So really, no transportation project of great import can happen in South Florida without Mario Diaz-Balart being on board. And I actually suspect that he will be working in a bipartisan fashion with a lot of these new delegation members, particularly those in South Florida, meaning specifically Congresswoman Shalala, Congresswoman Mercosso-Powell, to try and see if we can help alleviate a lot of these many issues that folks understand from a transportation perspective are happening through the allocation of federal dollars.
There's some really big departures from Congress in 2018. Ileana Ross-Leighton, who, by the way, now is working for the lobbying firm Akin Gump in Washington, D.C., Carlos Curbelo, who was defeated by Mercosso-Powell. What will be the impact of Ross-Leighton's absence in Congress? What did she bring? She was there a long time.
Well, I mean, she was the dean of the South Florida delegation. I mean, she had been there since 1989, almost a 30-year participation in Congress, not to mention one of, I would even say, outsized influence, significant influence. She was the chairwoman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which had tremendous impact on not only U.S. policy around the country and around the world, but in Latin America in particular. We know the residents of that in this community, and also a beloved member of the delegation. One thing about Congresswoman Ross-Leighton, and that even her fiercest critics would have to acknowledge, was that she was willing to work across the aisle when necessary, defy her party on issues of importance, whether they be the LGBT community or even on immigration. And I think the loss of that experience, the loss of that bipartisan spirit, is one that will have an impact.
Looking forward, as we had already said, I mean, this is a very different delegation. Again, it was 4-4 split, Republican, Democrat, and again, more women. What do you think is their greatest strength? What do you expect is going to come in the next 2 years?
Well, you know, it's such a fascinating dynamic. I don't know if the old ancient Chinese curse applies here. May you live in interesting times, because these are certainly interesting times with a very interesting delegation. But Louis, if you look at it, you've got so many different elements. In Donna Shalala, you know, you've got someone who ran a federal government agency in Health and Human Services, knows the South Florida community very well through her tenure at the University of Miami, brings kind of that seasoned experience with a great Rolodex. Contrast that with Debbie Mercosso-Powell, who brings the enthusiasm, the freshness, the energy of a relatively young person coming into politics for the first time, wanting to get a lot of stuff done, and then dealing with, you know, old pros like Mario Diaz-Balart on the Republican side, and still countering with folks like Congresswoman Frankel, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, as we mentioned before, Congressman Deutsch. It's a really interesting delegation, and I frankly anticipate good things for them, and I do believe we will see a bipartisan spirit, because I think you'll see, when necessary, on issues that are especially good for South Florida, I think you'll see Congressman Diaz-Balart amenable to some of these projects.
And then, of course, dealing with the government shutdown still.
You got to get past that one first, though.
First and foremost, get that out of the way. Fernand Amati, again, the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Amati Political Communications and Strategy Firm here in Miami. Again, talking about South Florida's new congressional delegation and their impact in Washington, D.C. Fernando, always a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much. Great show. Appreciate it.
All right, still to come, a panel conversation with a former Costa Rican president and a former member of the Obama administration to talk about further immigration policy. They're here for the State of the World Conference, which begins at Florida International University tomorrow. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as the conversation surrounding funding for the border wall at the U.S. southern border continues, one key question lawmakers will likely consider is how we view immigrants fleeing violence in places like Central America. The State of the World Conference begins at Florida International University tomorrow, where experts from around the country will discuss some of the most pressing policy issues, including issues on immigration. Now, one of the panel discussions is called Immigration, Who's In and Who's Out? Two of the panelists speaking on that panel join us now for that conversation. Luis Guillermo Solis Rivera is a distinguished visiting scholar at the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at FIU. And Mr. Rivera is the former president of Costa Rica. President Solis, welcome to the program. Such a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Also joining us is Ann Richards, Centennial Fellow at Georgetown University. Mrs. Richards served as Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration in the Obama administration. She joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mrs. Richards, it's such a pleasure.
Good afternoon.
President Solis, I want to start with you. The President of the United States went on national television last night and declared our country is facing an immigration crisis. Would you consider the situation at the border right now to be a crisis? How do you define that?
Well, it has been a very complex situation, but this is not a new situation. This has been going on for decades. And immigration in general, in the United States and other places, has to be seen and analyzed very carefully because of the implications it has, economic and human, and security ones. And I think that there is a growing concern in the United States to update the policy and do it differently. It's a phenomenon that it's not going to go away. In fact, it can increase. And I'm talking about Central America in particular. We can talk about that later. But I wouldn't say that it's the United States on the verge of an invasion that's going to destroy the country. No, this is a vision that I do not share.
Mrs. Richard, you know, during the Obama administration, I'm curious as to what were some of the refugee crisis and issues in Central America that you were charged with addressing, and what was the approach then?
Well, as your audience probably already knows, there are record levels of refugees and displaced people around the world right now, including from hotspots like Syria and the Horn of Africa. And that includes our own hemisphere. And we have people fleeing violence and insecurity in the Northern Triangle of Central America, the countries of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. One of the nice things for me about coming to the State of the World conference is I get to see President Solis again. I first met him in his office in Costa Rica when he was the president and I was the assistant secretary. And we worked together to try to find a way for Costa Rica to help, working with the UN Refugee Agency, to help some of the people who feared for their lives in the Northern Triangle of Central America and find a way for them to avoid the very dangerous trip across Mexico to find sanctuary in the U.S. and instead get a temporary protection in Costa Rica. So it's great to be united with him today on this program and to see, I'll be seeing him tomorrow.
And is something interesting too, wasn't it that, you know, you, going to Costa Rica were prepared to, you know, get into a battle if you had to try to talk him into, doing something to help in the refugee crisis. But he was very amenable to let's work this out.
Well, he probably remembers it better than I do, but I remember that I set out to convince him to do this and I didn't have to because he already knew and wanted to play a constructive role in the situation in Central America.
I want to hear from both of you on the word refugee and how it's being used and defined today, and if there's a problem with that. Mrs. Richard, let me start with you.
Well, the legal definition of refugee dates back to the 1951 International Convention that came out after World War II, and the idea was to help those fleeing persecution because of their political beliefs, membership in a social group, their race, their religion, their nationality, and to allow them to, if they had crossed an international border, to give them the protection that the world felt that they deserved. And today's crises are more complex. If you look at the people fleeing Central America, they're not being persecuted by their governments. They're being, their governments instead are failing to protect them from criminal gangs. And so this is a situation that was not anticipated by the drafters of that convention. Some immigration judges in the U.S. would say, yes, these people are refugees. Some politicians would say, no, there's criminality all over the world. They don't have a right to cross our border to claim asylum. What's very clear is that they're fleeing for their lives. So I would argue that we have a responsibility to help them.
President Solis, I wanted to get your take on that as well, is how we're using the word refugee today.
Oh, I completely agree with Ms. Richards. I think that we have a lacking of a better concept to include all of these migrants who are moving away from, running away from fear, from hunger, or looking for better opportunities. And the truth of the matter, when we talk about migrants, I like to look at them as people who are running away. I wrote an op-ed piece for El Herald here in Miami a couple of weeks ago, saying that they're not migrating, they're escaping. And the definition, the legal definition, comes short to that new condition of millions of people who are leaving their countries of birth to seek refuge from these conditions. So the way we're using the concept is not being helpful to provide for the multilateral support that these populations require.
And by the way, too, is that Costa Rica is a refugee status determination country. What does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody who comes to the country and requests becoming a refugee gets the opportunity to become one. And we are very strict in allowing this condition to be given if the persons who are in requesting it can prove their condition. And it, generally, we have welcomed, especially people coming from other countries in Latin America that require this protection. And lately, we've had thousands of Nicaraguan new immigrants coming into the country. We have already some over 500,000 Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica, according to the latest census, probably more people. Just in the last few months, over 50,000 new people have come in after the crisis, the political crisis in Nicaragua. So,
Mrs. Richards, I want to come back to you. Let's return to when you reached out to President Solis and you wanted to, you know, get Costa Rica on board in the issues of dealing with refugees back then. I mean, what was going on? Just remind us again, what was happening at the time?
Well, the Obama administration was very firm in wanting to help refugees all around the world. And we were trying to resettle more refugees from various crisis zones in the United States. We were the leader in providing humanitarian assistance around the world. And we were also concerned, though, about the Southwest border, that the number of people coming, well, actually the profile of the people coming had shifted. As you know, a decade ago, Mexican, primarily men, would be coming north to find jobs. Now, however, we have a very different group of people coming north. We are not seeing a majority of Mexicans coming north. In fact, many have gone home again. Instead, we are seeing this very vulnerable group coming north from the Northern Triangle of Central America. So the Obama administration pushed a package of measures that included providing assistance to the governments in those countries so that they did a better job protecting their own people. It also involved talking to Mexico, working multilaterally with UN Refugee Agency, the International Organization for Migration. And of course, it also involved doing things at the Southwest border. But it wasn't one simple response. It was a multifaceted response.
We're talking again with Ann Richard, a Centennial Fellow at Georgetown University. She served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration under the Obama administration. Also talking with Luis Guillermo Solis Rivera, a distinguished visiting scholar at FIU. He was the president of Costa Rica from 2014 to 2018. They're going to be part of a conversation this week. It's part of the State of the World Conference at FIU, and it begins tomorrow. And that is free and open to the public. We'll have more information on our website, WLRN.org. President Solis, how is Costa Rica dealing with the refugee issue? As Mrs. Richards was talking about, you had people from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador coming through, trying to get to the United States, or at least trying to get out where they were. But how did Costa Rica deal with that?
Well, we had three waves of immigrants that were problematic during my my tenure. We had a Cuban migration that was very...
And the Cuban, thank you for bringing that up.
That was significant. We had over 8,000 Cubans that came from Ecuador. We had the Nicaraguan situation at the very end of my tenure. And then we had over 23,000 Haitian coming from Brazil. So we had a situation that was pretty complex. We dealt with it with different approaches. First of all, we had to guarantee that these people were not being subject to the coyote phenomenon. As some of our listeners may know, human trafficking is horrible.
The smugglers, the coyotes.
The smugglers, the coyotes. And it's probably more profitable a business than drugs, human trafficking. So we gave them authorization to be in the country for over 30 days so that they could, move around without fear of the authorities. That was one thing. And then ensure that they had the conditions necessary for a decent life while they were in country, and they move on. In the case of the Cubans, we had a very difficult time because Nicaragua shut down their borders. And while they were not willing to stay in any country of Central America, they wanted to come to the United States and take advantage of the privileges that they had, they had to go through, and they wouldn't allow them to go through. And this was an enticing factor for the coyotes to work from Nicaragua onward. So we had to have, and this is the third element, not only safe passage and good conditions, but multilateral cooperation. We needed the support of other countries to deal with this. This is not a single country's issue. It entails many other nations as well.
And over time, what was the attitude of the Costa Rican people as they're dealing with refugees? Because you see this in other countries. When refugees are coming through or coming in, at some point tension starts to grow.
Absolutely. And it happened in Costa Rica as well. I think that by and large, the Costa Rican population was very generous with the immigration flow. With the Cuban population, integration and support was immediate. It was a love affair almost with the Cubans because they looked alike, they spoke the language, they ate the same things we eat, they got to the country at the end of the year. They were incorporated into the festivities of Christmas and the New Year. With the Haitian population, there was a little more resistance, mainly because they spoke a different language. They had a different, they were black, and this was an issue for many communities that had not seen black populations in those numbers. They had different uses, cultural uses as well, but by and large, we didn't have violence. We had some incidents, but produced by the Haitians that wanted to move on and do whatever they wanted to do. And I must be clear, and I think that Mrs. Richards would coincide with me. I mean, we have laws that need to be applied. And with the Nicaraguan population, we have a sweet-sour relationship. It has been like that for decades.
Mrs. Richards, as part of your work with the Obama administration, you were charged with advising leadership on temporary protected status for specific communities. But TPS is challenging because it's meant to be temporary. Do you think the system works in its current iteration?
You've hit the nail on the head that temporary protective status for various groups who are in the United States when a crisis breaks out in their home country and they're allowed to stay and they're not forced back, it's intended to be temporary, and for some groups, years and years and years have gone on. So I would suggest that perhaps we need to institute a change in our understanding of it, and that after 7 or 10 years pass and the situation in their home country has not improved, then perhaps we should look at allowing these folks, those who want to plan to stay and become residents of the U.S. and put down roots. Because as we all know, life takes place. People fall in love. They get married. They have kids here. They get jobs. They have mortgages. And so it becomes almost cruel to push people back if they've been in the United States for a long time making their lives. And of course, I'm talking about people who are law-abiding and who make a contribution to our country, as most immigrants and refugees do.
And the Trump administration is ending TPS certifications for thousands of Salvadorans, Haitians, Nicaraguans this year, later this year, many again who reside here in South Florida. Do we have a sense of the options available to these individuals at this point?
Well, I think they're going to have to plan to go back. But for youth who have grown up in the United States, who haven't spent time in their home countries, this could be a real difficult situation for them. You know, we are a country of refugees and immigrants, and most Americans have in the past supported that. In fact, this had been in the past a bipartisan issue. I know earlier in your program you were talking about Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, who has stepped down from her position. She chose not to run again for, as a congresswoman in Miami, but she was one of the people on the when I was a Democratic, a political appointee, I could turn to her as a Republican congresswoman, and we could have a very good conversation about helping refugees. And people in Florida get it because so many Cuban Americans came, fled Cuba when it was, you know, and fled communism. And that the understanding that Cubans fleeing communism or people in the Cold War fleeing the Soviet sphere, that these people should be taken into our country, that was something really well understood. And so something has changed in our society. We have political leaders who are hostile to refugees and immigrants, and I think this is really a shame. And that to the extent we can, we have to really re-knit this bipartisan support for bringing in people to our country, giving them an opportunity, especially if they are vulnerable.
And President Solis, because you mentioned this a moment ago about how Costa Rica was dealing with a lot of these refugees. And part of it was, look, this is, it's, I got the sense of what you said. It's like, well, this is temporary. We're going to help you, but this is temporary. And so this issue of TPS, I mean, you have people who've been living in the United States now for many years, so they built roots.
They
here.
Are here. Yeah.
And
are.
So, I mean, your take on this idea of any country's responsibility to any group of refugees they're seeking help, is it supposed to be temporary, or do we say, you know what, we open ourselves up to you as well?
Well, it could be temporary, and in fact, you know, I continue to insist that we should be responsible in the countries that originate the immigration of the conditions of the country so that people don't leave. I mean, if you see Costa Ricans abroad, are relatively few, because if you are put in the position of choosing to leave or stay in a compound, you're going to stay if you have, you know, basic conditions. So the responsibility of providing for those conditions are from the original countries, or the countries from they come from. It is our responsibility to keep them there. So I would say that if we are able to move forward from the state in which we are at this point, people would probably like to come, but not those who have already lived here for generations or for decades. It's going to be very difficult for them to go away. They are providing services that this country needs. They are doing a lot of jobs that Americans do not want to do. So they're not going to.
And also, look, part of it is the fact that in a lot of these countries, they don't want to go back.
Absolutely, and they're right.
But then what role do we play in that? Well, we being the United States, what role does the United States play?
Well, a very important role, because not only in terms of providing short-term cooperation resources, which I find continue to be important, like the ones the United States have put forward, including in the Trump administration. I mean, it is a mistake to cut short that assistance. But there's more. Investments, for example, that can be promoted, which I find, it's one of the things I find curious, you know, that the countries, if Central America could be even punished further, if, for example, the CAFTA-DR, the Central American-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, is revised, as I hear today, that could be revised by the Trump administration, that's going to put more strain upon the economies of the region, and investments and creation of jobs are going to be more difficult.
Mrs. Richard, what do you think about the long-term implications of some of President Trump's immigration policies? Again, it's between in its relations between the United States and Latin America.
Well, one of the things that I think is very important that was at the core of what President Solis was just saying is that you don't just look at the numbers of people showing up at your border. you look at why are they there, and then you track back to the crisis in their home countries that are forcing them to flee for their lives. You know, it was interesting, the president last night, for the first time, I think, mentioned it was a humanitarian crisis. He talked about the dangers on the route through Mexico. And this is not news. Those dangers are well understood by the people traveling north. That's why many of them chose to travel as a caravan, even though the president described it as an invading army. It was actually people coming together to protect themselves. And the reason they're fleeing, even though it's dangerous, is because it's even more dangerous to stay where they are. They're being threatened and targeted by criminal gangs, narco traffickers. So I think we need our development experts, diplomats, engagement with foreign countries, support of multilateral organizations that know how to improve situations. We need to have good relations with the countries that are seeing their people flee. We need to encourage those countries to be good governments. So we need to look abroad and focus on the origins of these migrant flows, and especially of people who are refugees fleeing for their lives.
This is a fascinating conversation that the two of you are going to continue again tomorrow. This is, again, talking with Luis Guillermo Solis Rivera, distinguished visiting scholar at FIU and also former president of Costa Rica, and Ann Richard, Centennial Fellow at Georgetown University. Again, they're talking at the panel on immigration, and actually it's Friday as part of the university's State of the World event. The event starts tomorrow. They're going to be talking on Friday. We'll have more details on our website, WLRN.org. I have to end it there. President Solis, it's been such a pleasure. Mrs. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to, I would love to see you again, Anne. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
As we finish up here on the program, I want to switch gears a little bit and tell you about the story at Miami Beach. This is a brief update on the battle between the home sharing platform Airbnb and the city of Miami Beach. Last week, Airbnb filed a lawsuit in Miami federal court over the recent short-term rental restrictions that the city has put in place. Earlier today, we spoke with the Miami Herald reporter Kira Gurney about the lawsuit and which side has the upper hand.
So Airbnb sued Miami Beach last week because the city passed an ordinance recently that would require rental platforms like Airbnb to only post listings when they have a business license and resort tax registration number. Essentially, that means that that property owner has registered with the city and that they're in an area of Miami Beach where it's legal for them to have a short-term rental. And so initially in the ordinance, the city of Miami Beach had said that platforms could get around this new requirement if they use this technology called geofencing, which means that they would block property owners from listing properties in a prohibited area. But what Airbnb is saying in their lawsuit is that they tried to use this exemption by putting in place this geofencing or geocoding, and Miami Beach told them that they actually still have to go ahead and comply with the rest of the new restrictions.
Yeah, and it wasn't that long ago that the city and reps from Airbnb had met, and then the city tells them, but you have to do this extra layer. And then, of course, Airbnb drops the lawsuit. What else is the company claiming, and why is it doing what it's doing now?
So the company is claiming that the new restrictions Miami Beach passed last September violate a federal law that's known as the Communications Decency Act. And essentially, this is a law that protects websites, like a lot of social media platforms, from being held responsible for content that their users post. So, you know, if you post something that could be considered defamatory on Facebook, Facebook isn't going to be held liable for that. And that's a pretty broad law that covers a lot of internet activity.
Does that mean that Airbnb qualifies as a social media site?
Well, they're referring to themselves as a platform. And so this law protects platforms, which include social media sites. And Airbnb's vision of this also include short-term rental sites like Airbnb and HomeAway and VRBO.
This has been a contentious issue for a while. There are people who love the idea because it definitely helps them to make extra income, and other people hate it because they don't want homes turned into vacation rentals. But what have you heard from residents? How are they split on the issue?
I would say most often I hear from residents who are upset that there are short-term rentals in their buildings, which aren't allowed in most residential areas of the city. They feel that these rentals, you know, often become party destinations, that it hurts their quality of life. But I do also hear from residents who use short-term rentals as a way of supplementing their income. And residents who feel that these rentals offer some more economical alternatives to some of the expensive hotels in Miami Beach.
Is there precedence in this sort of case? I mean, who has the upper hand here?
So the Communications Decency Act, from what I understand, is pretty expansive. So there perhaps is a lot of legal cover in that sense. But Airbnb sued the city of San Francisco a couple years ago on similar grounds, and they ended up reaching a settlement in which Airbnb essentially agreed to San Francisco's demands that they help enforce the restrictions that San Francisco has, which are fairly similar to the ones that Miami Beach recently passed.
That was Kira Gurney, reporter for the Miami Herald, giving us an update on the Airbnb lawsuit against the city of Miami Beach. And we want to hear from you. Anywhere in South Florida, do you think there should be strict laws against Airbnb, or should any homeowner be allowed to turn their property into a rental? Find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Well, that's the program for this Wednesday, January 9th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.